Hey, and welcome back to all you Yankees and the ships at sea, and welcome to the triumphant return of Skid Row Chatter after a couple-month hiatus. We have returned with a special episode with Mr. Jay Stringer, live, although you may not be hearing it live when you're listening to it, live from Glasgow. Jay was, I don't know if I should roll through your entire bio here, since it does have some information you might want to share on your own.
Go for it.
Jay Stringer was born in 1980. God, Lord, you're just a pup. I can do math. You're much younger than me. And he's not dead yet. He was raised in Black Country, which I had to actually Google. Now I know where it is. And now calls Glasgow home. His loyalties are divided between England and Scotland, unfortunately. Where do they lay these days? Not when you wrote the bio.
Well, Jay? Where are my loyalties now?
Yeah. Are they still divided?
I consider myself mostly Scottish, but it seems to be a matter for debate with Scottish crime writers about whether they think I'm Scottish or not. So
that's what matters.
I think it depends on whether there are Americans around. When it's just me and them drinking in a bar, they all say I'm Scottish. But the minute we go to Bouchercon and there are Americans in the room, all the Scottish authors are very quick to point out that I'm English.
Yeah, it's a disclaimer. Yep, a little distancing. I understand. Jay is dyslexic and came to the written word as a second language via comic books, music, and comedy. And as a child, he spent his time dreaming of living in the New York of Daredevil comics and crime fiction. But as an adult, he's channeled those dreams into fiction of his own. Jay writes dark, hard-boiled crime stories, dark comedies, and social fiction. His heart beats for the outsider, for the people without a voice. He coined the term social pulp fiction, catchy, to describe his style. And you can catch him at Twitter, on Facebook, and everywhere else that the internet is turned on and available. Welcome to the show, Jay. How you doing?
Thanks for having me. It's great fun to be here.
Well, it is. It's Saturday night where you are. It's Saturday morning where I am. But in a show of unity, I did crack a fine Mordello Especial beer that I'm drinking at 12:03, just to lubricate the conversation.
And I'm going the other way. I'm drinking a coffee.
Well, you know, I've gone back to back now, so if I have to get up and go to the bathroom during the interview, just keep on just vamp without me. But the primary reason I kind of wanted you to come on and chat for a little bit is the release of the Replacements anthology, which is your baby. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the band themselves, they've always been, well, they haven't always been important to me because there was a time when I was a child and couldn't speak and things like that. But my whole adult life, they've been very important to me. And I'd always thought that one day I would do some kind of writing project about the band. But to be honest, I always thought I'd write a biography, but I've been beaten to that by someone who's written a really good one. And then one day after...
There's a couple of biographies out now. Which one are you referring to is the good one?
The Trouble Boys, and I'm currently forgetting the name, Bob Mayer. I only recently read it, and it's very, very exhaustive in its detail. It tells a lot of stories behind the scenes, and also it goes into the background about... it does stuff I knew about. I knew all the war stories about the recording of the albums and the fun things they did with alcohol and drugs and throwing up, but it talks about their childhood, which I didn't know about. And once you understand their childhood, I think you understand the whole band in a whole new way.
There's a great sort of Midwestern sort of rich tradition there that's just wired right into their DNA that I think really comes out. As we're saying, you were beaten to the punch by the real biographer. So what was your spin? What was your contribution to the Replacements?
Well, so we were on we were on that magical Facebook place talking about, and I think it was a conversation inspired at the time by Joe Clifford's Springsteen anthology. And I was saying, and this is where I blame you, because I was saying, it'd be great if someone someday did the same kind of thing for the Replacements. So for anyone who hasn't read the Springsteen book, it's short stories inspired by Springsteen songs. And there's a whole bunch of great authors in there. And so I was saying, it'd be great if someone did that someday in the future. And then it was yourself who got in touch and said, well, why not right now?
Yeah, well, I think the idea at the time, Gutter was kind of looking at maybe making a series of music-related anthologies. But who knows where the rocky path leads as each book comes out. But, the thing that struck me about you know, Springsteen was just so such a common denominator for so many people. He's so, and I will say it, he's middle of the road. And for those of us that were on the fringe and on the alternative of the music scene and stuff, the Replacements, at least to me, hit more of a chord to my heart. Not that, you know, not that there's anything wrong with Bruce, but the Replacement spoke to me as a person, as a young man, and still as an adult, as like a disenfranchised outsider. They still have that ring. And so I thought the idea of all these crime writers contributing their crime stories would be a great assemblage of stories, just like the collection that the Bruce collection was. But it turned out a lot different in my view. It turned out different, wouldn't you say?
It's yes and no. I know exactly where you're coming from. I think it turned out a little bit different by design, because I very much set out. And it goes actually back to what you're saying about Springsteen. That, I mean, I'm a Springsteen fan, but I also get exactly what you say about him, and I think a lot of it's true to an extent. But I think the Springsteen, it was clear with the Springsteen anthology. It was clear that there are crime stories there, and you know what you're going to get.
Right.
As great as they are, you know, there was a clear connection between some of his songs and crime fiction. You kind of think, well, I know what this collection's going to be. And part of the challenge and part of the fun for me of these Replacements is that they speak to me in exactly the same way that you're saying. But it doesn't, their songs don't, sometimes they speak in a crime fiction way, but sometimes it's just in kind of a heartbreak way or a foiled ambition kind of way, or, you know, a dead end kind of way. And so I thought it'd be a fun challenge to throw that band out there, because it's not quite like Springsteen. It's not where you know what you're going to get in terms of crime fiction. It's let's put this band out there, and let's see what comes back. So it's a very different tone, I think, to the Springsteen book.
There's a lot of I said it before, and it's true. As you go through the collection, there's a lot of heart and heartbreak. There's a lot of emotion under there, which for, you know, a rough and tumble band full of, you know, sort of whistle in the dark drinking songs, you know, that's their sort of image. But underneath it all, just like the Replacements and their songs, the stories have a real sort of tenderness that I was really struck as when I went through them all together. I was like, wow, you know, that's a real unifying theme.
Yeah, and I think it's because it's in the music. They're a band who I think you bring yourself to a band. So really, when you're listening to any musician, what you're saying about them is all you're doing is you're reflecting a bit of yourself. You're reflecting your own tastes. So I think different people can talk about their Replacements and each reflect themselves and say that they like the band for a different reason. But I think underneath it all, there is that emotion. There is a real emotional core, and I think that's why the band stick with people. There's funny one-liners in their songs. You know, there is hard drinking. There's lovable losers. But underneath all of that, there's a real emotional core that I think we take away with us. And that's, I mean, for me, that's what brings me back to them again and again, because the emotion will age with you as you get older and you experience different things in life. You can go back to that band and find that the mixed up emotions that you liked when you were 18, you like the songs just as much when you're 36 or onwards, for the mixed up emotions, because you're still feeling them. They haven't gone away.
Did you feel like you were like born too late when it came to the Replacements? I mean, they formed in 80, right? Wasn't that the year they started?
They gigged, they formed in 79, and I think their first gig would have been like December 79 or early 80, somewhere around there.
Which although puts Tommy at 12, which is awfully young, but it also puts you at -1. So, I mean, I had that sensation with a lot of music that I admired and grew up on, that it all sort of happened before, just as I was coming into the world. And so there was that constant, you know, looking back and feeling like I didn't really experience things firsthand. And it took me a long time in life to figure out that you know, it doesn't really matter. But I was hung up on it when I was young, and I didn't appreciate the fact that when I did see the Replacements and stuff in 88, that I was, you know, I felt then even like, oh, it's pleased to meet me. I'm missing the real Replacements when they were really around, when they were, you know, and I look back now and I'm glad I saw them the few times that I did back in the old days, you know. Did you have that sort of feeling?
A little bit. I mean, I'd always had that growing up. I've just come to think that I think that's the lot in life for a music fan. Cause you're always, there's always going to be a couple of bands who are around kind of 10 years before your time, who've therefore got this big body of work that you can listen to that's going to feel more complete than whatever's, you know, being made fresh when you're young. So I definitely did feel that when I was younger. And so a lot of my favorite acts were the people like The Replacements, people from kind of 10, 15 years before. I mean, I was lucky that I was getting into music in the 90s when kind of alt country and things like that were happening as well. So there were things that were specific to my tastes at the time. You know, I got to be a Whiskey Town fan at the time they were putting albums out. So, you know, I did have things that were mine, but a lot of my tastes were, you know, kind of 70s and 80s. And but then, you know, my parents, they did exactly the same for the decade before them. And I know people who are younger than me who are now pining for music that I hated in the 90s. So I just think it's a lot in life for a music fan, is you like whatever was kind of 5-10 years before you.
Well, it's funny, you know, it always makes me think of that Woody Allen movie, Midnight in Paris, where, you know, he yearns to go back to the left bank, and we get there, he meets the girl who just yearns to go back to the 1890s, and it makes you realize that this, like you say, it's just an ongoing, it's part of, I guess, the human condition. How was it seeing, you know, on the triumphant Replacement Return to Conquer the World tour, how was it finally seeing them?
It was amazing. It was life-changing. I think one of the worries for me with them is that it's easy to be a legend when you don't have to back it up. I think one of the other reasons that a lot of us tend to like bands from slightly before our time is because they can be a legend and you don't have to go and be disappointed by them.
Sure.
The Replacements, I think, specific to the internet age, you know, as the internet and message boards have grown up, they're one of the bands who've really become an even bigger legend off the back of that. And they could have just turned up and milked it, played a few, well, not hits for them, but, you know, a few popular songs, put out an album, and we would have all convinced ourselves that we liked it because we liked the band. But deep down, we would have known it was just like every other reforming band, and we wouldn't have really loved it. They just turned up and they played, I can't even remember, they played longer than I thought. I thought we'd get just over an hour, and we got an actual proper gig. And they just rocked it. They just turned up, and it was almost like they felt the pressure of the legend, and they wanted to turn up on stage and say, so much gets written about us, about Westerberg's lyrics and the meaning and stuff that I've been doing, you know, now talking about the emotion and all that. And it's like, we're just going to turn up and remind you that we were a rock and roll band. So they played for a couple of hours, just, you know, hard and fast rock and roll, amazing stuff, and then they left, and then a week later, they'd split up again. It was just, we proved that point.
In true form. Well, I will say this. I think I've seen them, I saw them four times in the original, including their very last tour that was supposed to be the farewell tour where they were all sober. And they were awfully good that tour. But I don't think, from my limited experience, they were ever as good as the night on Joe Clifford and I went and saw them in San Francisco. And I know it was only half the band, you know, but they really delivered, like you said. And there was all the sort of fun and craziness about them was there, and it without seeming forced or put on, it was a good show, and it really made me reconnect with what I loved about them and what I loved about their sort of fuck you approach to music, you know, or to everybody else in music and what people thought of them. They just kind of cut their own path, and which is why I guess we're still talking and writing about them today.
Yeah, I mean they were their own people, and the more you learn about the band, the more you learn stuff that makes them more human and relatable to me. That we can talk about how they did everything on their own terms, which is true. They failed on their own terms, but half of that was also because they were too scared to try sometimes. And I think rather than making them less relatable, finding out more about this band makes them more relatable, because you just read stuff and you think, well, that's me. I'm the guy who will kind of put on a shell and try a little bit and then sometimes not try. And, you know, it's that mix that I think is human. Whereas a lot of bands, the more you read about them, can sometimes be a bad thing, because you find out bad things that you don't like.
Yeah. You have that. And you realize how much polishing of turds can go on when rock and roll journalists put somebody on the pedestal. But listen, before I shift gears on you, I do want to mention that this is a copyrighted, trademarked podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. That way I don't have the team of lawyers on my ass. Believe me, you don't want the bevy of lawyers coming after you. So, you know, Jake Stringer, the man behind the book, doesn't happen in a vacuum. What's, I've only sort of been tuned into you is in the Thomas and Mercer days, and I was researching a little bit more about you, and you had a series that was out well before the Glasgow books, right?
Yeah, well, my first three books were a trilogy that was set back where I'd grown up in the Midlands, in the Black Country, in England, and they were the Glasgow books are. They're mostly comedies. I mean, they're crime books, and they've got violence, a lot of violence in them. But at their heart, you know, I'm going for the jokes with those books. But the first three books were a lot more dark. They were me being serious and political and social and talking about racism and, you know, immigration and politics and all of that stuff that you've probably heard me do at the bar after I'm drunk.
But that serious voice is what got you signed to the bigger publisher, and yet you decided to cut your own spot then and say, I'm going to lighten it up and abandon what you signed me for.
Have I ever mentioned that I based my career on Paul Westerberg?
Well, good luck to you then, lad.
there was a definite change in gear that I think the publisher noticed, and they supported it. They were very supportive once they bought into the idea that there's a version of me, I think, that was in the first three books that was very, I mean, there were jokes in there, but it was very, very dark. But that wasn't the version of me that they would meet when we went out for dinner. Who's, you know,
right.
I'm cracking jokes a lot. So I think they actually embraced the idea that maybe I should put more of my humor into the books. We'll see where it goes from there. But
your publisher is, I mean, that's an American deal, right? You. They don't have an office over there that you came down and signed, and that was something that happened stateside, correct?
They do. They've got a UK. There's a UK Thomas and Mercer now. When I first signed with them, it was US. I was
right.
signed by the American team, and you know, kind of managed out of the Seattle office for the first three books. The Glasgow books have been with the UK team because they do have one now. So I was there before them. And sometimes I just like I'll needle them a little bit just for comedy effect, just to say, you know, I've been here longer than you guys.
Do you ever pound your fist on their desk and say, and I'll be here long after you're gone? Keep them in
line. I'll go and try that and report back.
Well, I guess the thing that I'm getting at is you seem like you spend a lot of time for a starving writer in Glasgow, in the States. You're able to get over. I've always sort of viewed you as part of the core community in the neo-noir scene, and I'm just wondering how that comes about. Do you feel, you know, oddly disconnected from being across the Atlantic, or do you feel connected to the American scene, and that's something that separates you from your peers in the UK?
I'm definitely more connected in the US scene. I think I'm more connected in the US scene than the UK scene. I turn up to festivals or conferences that in America, and people know me. I don't mean that in kind of a big way in terms of fans, but I mean the people at the places know me, you know, and we know each other and we hang out and we talk. I think it's always been a bit of a conscious effort from me. I mean, when my agent's an American, she's in New York, and when we were first kind of get me started into being published and how to build a brand and all of that kind of wankery. I co-founded Do Some Damage with Steve Weddle, and my focus has always been in trying to be known in the American crime fiction circuit more than the UK one. And that, you know, that can have its downsides because I can turn up to UK festivals and sometimes nobody knows who I am. I get more drinks paid for in America, so
I don't know if it balances out to the airfare over, but I'm sure it's close. Do Some Damage is and that's really where perhaps my perception of you being one of the columns of the community really comes from, because that's out of all the blogs and websites and stuff that comes and goes, that's one that I actually go and read and I refer to and I'll check back on and catch up with. And it's a great service. Can you explain it for any of our listeners out there? Do Some Damage, you can Google it right away. But can you explain what the concept is behind that?
Yeah, I mean, it's shifted quite a bit. What we started out, I mean, we started in 2009. That alone makes me feel like I've been doing this for too long. and the original idea was we said we were going to, very, very pretentious, we said we were going to pull back the curtain on crime fiction and show people the insides of it. And what we decided was that we'd put together a team. I know, right? And I came up with that phrase.
Who wants to look behind that curtain? It's like there's nothing going on back there.
Yeah.
Show me what's in front
sometimes
of the
I
curtain.
Need somebody to tell me to stop being a dick, and nobody in that conversation told me to stop being a dick. But what we originally set out to do was we put together a team, a kind of a mixed team. So we had people who were already published, people who were agented but not published, people who haven't been published and didn't have an agent. And we just wanted to kind of put together a cocktail of all the different stages of the career.
Right.
And originally we were going to stick to crime fiction. We actually had a running bet inside our little group about which of us was going to be the first person to veer off that. And it was me, because I think 3 weeks in, I started posting about comic books. But over the years, it's the team's changed. You know, we've originally, the very first, and me and Steve both kind of put our hands up to this, that we could have done more originally. The first team we put together was basically all white men. So that then we thought, no, this isn't good enough. So over the years, we've just got better at trying to reflect the broader community of crime fiction. Every single day, there's a new post from one of the members, and it can be about crime fiction, or it can be about anything they want to write about. It can be about themselves. It can be about politics, publishing, whatever. You can go there every single day, and there's new content.
And I love the slow rotation of the contributors. It's like a pro baseball team or something that you know, every once in a while there's a new pitcher, but the whole team doesn't change. So it's like a great menu at a restaurant. It evolves. It doesn't you know completely change. One day you walk in, it's a whole other thing. There's a continuity there that I appreciate. And since we're talking about it clearly has done good things for you, right? Overall.
Yeah, I think it gave me it was part of, I mean, part of what you were saying about how I'm known in the US scene. I think a large part of that was Do Some Damage. It was a large part of my kind of networking and outreach, so that I can walk into a bar at a Bauchicon or a Left Coast Crime over there, and there'll be someone who knows me, even if it's because they want to kind of pull me up for something I've said that they don't like. It was definitely part of that. And then I think that definitely helped and get me noticed to get a book deal, because something that publishers will look at is, do you have a platform? You know, are you something that they can already see themselves selling, you know, and packaging and selling? So I think having not a following for myself, but a following for Do Some Damage, I think it helped me to try and make people think I had a following.
Hey, it's smoke and mirrors. Smoke and mirrors, baby.
Oh, totally.
Do you feel smoke and mirrors. Do you feel hemmed in sometimes by the crime fiction title or do you feel pigeonholed?
That's a good question. I write stuff that isn't crime at all, and that stuff so far doesn't get published. So maybe. I mean, I think there's a problem for anyone starting out that you want to. It takes so much effort to build a career in publishing. It takes so much effort to get, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 books in, get to the point when you're a steady seller or any kind of seller, that it makes sense to focus on one thing. And sometimes you can close yourself down and stop writing, you know, everything else. I mean, for me, the Glasgow books are completely different to my first three books. So I'm, you know, I'm finding ways to do other stuff. And there's also the expectation of when someone picks up one of your books, I'm always very conscious that I don't want someone to pick up my book and have a bad time. And so I don't even want to kind of laugh at the kind of reader who wouldn't like my stuff. I actually want them to know in advance. I'd be happier for someone to know in advance that they won't like my stuff than to invest in it and have a bad time reading it. And that's my only worry with the crime fiction label is it can be sometimes hard to get across to some people and go, look, it's like, this might not be your thing. You know, I don't want you to have a bad time.
Or maybe if you're a crazy crime fiction buff, it may not even be your thing. It might be a little too much levity there if you're looking for a McBain novel or something like that.
Absolutely.
Let me rephrase it this way. When you first started writing the books that became, you know, that were published as crime novels, did you set out to write a crime novel, or did you just set out to write a novel and it happened to have a lot of crime in it? You know, because that's the way I feel.
Yeah.
When I'm just trying to write the damn story and it just comes out the way it is. I didn't intend to be in a genre. It just the way it came out.
Yeah, it's where we end up. I think, I mean, by the time the books that are out, so the that the first one that came out was All Gold. And by the time I was writing that one, I knew I was writing a crime novel, and I was specifically playing with a few tropes of crime novels. So I was very conscious about it. See, I sound like a wanker again. I said playing with the tropes of a novel, but I knew I was doing it. But on the way there, you know, as I was learning to write short fiction and learning the ropes, that was when I was going through the process of, you know, just writing the stories that appealed to me, and then finding out that they were generally crime stories. I mean, when I was a teenager, the songs that I like, you can look back on and see, you can see that they're crime. The plays that I liked, you can look back and see that they're crime. The comic books that I liked, you can look back again, and they've all got crime in them. So yeah. I think it was just that process of one day just sitting down and going, huh, I guess I like crime fiction.
Sure enough. Hey, listen, I hear through the grapevine that Angel Colon is out there somewhere, but he doesn't know how to call in, or perhaps he's just hasn't paid his phone bill. But at any rate, I will tell you, if you're listening out there, contributor Angel, that it is the guest call-in is 347-633-9609. And although we're only semi-live, I know there's a few folks listening out there, because I did let some folks know. But once again, I'll tell you the number anyway, 347-633-9609. And I can tell there's somebody calling, and I'm not sure whether Pam has to get them or I do, because I'm doing the remote thing.
It's definitely not me getting it. That's all I know.
Hello. Welcome. You're on Skid Row Chatter with world famous Jay Stringer. Hello.
Hey.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here now.
Introduce yourself, Stringer.
Guy.
Hello.
Angel. Welcome.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Well, we're in the middle of a radio show. You're interrupting us. What do you need? No, just kidding.
I figured you guys didn't have enough fucking accents on the air of varying degrees, so I'd pitch in my East Coast mess to get it all.
I'm sorry you were having trouble understanding my thick Canadian accent.
it's not too bad. You're not rocking your boot, so I can kind of catch on to certain words when I clink.
I do like to pepper my lexicon with apologies, though. So that's really important. Common denominator. Andrew, you're a contributor. Tell us a little bit about your story and Waiting to be Forgotten.
Yeah, man. I chose Kiss Me on the Bus, which was, funny enough, just kind of a shot in the dark, just because I always had a little something in my back pocket for that. And it's just, you guys were talking about before how the stories are a little less, I don't know if it's a little less pulp, a little more almost like darkly romantic.
Yeah.
I think that suited the Replacements. When I sat down and actually put it together, I was like, yeah, you know, as much as I think Jay was talking about the putting in humor and doing all that, I didn't feel like that was necessarily the right match. So I wanted to do something a little more about like love lost and all that forlorn garbage. And the title of the song was kind of suited to my own experiences taking when I first got married. I used to live in Queens and I worked in New Jersey. I would take like a 5 o'clock train into the city to take a bus out into Jersey. And my bus was kind of the open shift for the methadone folk. So I'd be the
I've
only
been on that
of,
bus.
Yeah. And I was like, the only guy with any color in his skin on this bus. And, you'd have like 12 people and we would, next to my stop where my job was a stop at the hospital, and they'd all get off, go do their thing. And, I always be like, this is just, it was fascinating to me because everybody was just kind of quiet. It was never anything really dramatic, but I said, I'll do a story about those folk, do something and maybe do something like not so much a crime story, but a romance, So that's what the story's about. It's about a guy who kind of falls for a girl who's in the same place as him, and like a replacement song, it doesn't really end up being as uplifting as you'd hope it'd be.
I would like to share, speaking of uplifting, whenever my daughter hears that song, she likes to change the chorus to Kiss Me on the Butt. And that always does.
that was my initial pitch. My initial pitch was that, but I didn't think that would fly with Jay.
That's the next rock and roll anthology is songs with misunderstood lyrics.
Yeah.
Oh, I love those kind of songs. I mean, Son of a Preacher Man, come on, it's a very smutty song. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
I'm actually going to say something nice about Angel here briefly, is that his was one of the stories that came in early on that made me realize that my idea was going to work. I mean, my idea for what it could be. because it's one that came in and I thought like he gets the tone, he gets the point. We can do this. Whereas before I was a bit worried about what if all I get is you know dark, violent crime, or what if all I get is one thing or another thing. But he sent in a story where I thought, oh he gets it. He gets the mixed emotion.
Yeah, and they kept on coming that way. You know, it's funny too. I was very worried about having a pale imitation of the Springsteen anthology, you know, or an echo of it, and it really is unique unto itself, and it is a separate entity. You know, it stands on its own, but you're right. It's a different feel. There's a different texture to it. And I'm really proud of the book and for my little involvement with it. I'm proud to have been able to do something to further its birth into the world.
Little involvement, says the man who came up with the initial idea to do it and did the cover and pushed it out into the world.
I'm the doctor in the back of the room going, breathe. And I should also say Rob Pierce, who doesn't have a story in the book, but he really he did a bang up job missing stuff that what we both missed. I was like, Rob, maybe you should just give it a once over. And he said back to me, I was like, oh well, I might want to get new glasses. But
that's
all
how you
in
spell
all, and
AMD?
Oh, yeah, AMD. Yeah, it was a rough birth, and I'm glad it's finally out there in the world, walking on its own. It looked like the party that Steve Loudon held last night, the release party in Los Angeles, went rather well, and hopefully
that
it works out.
That was fantastic. That was fantastic. It was really surreal being at that party while not being there. I felt like Max Headroom. It was just this little iPad in the corner of the room that was my face, and I was there. I was talking to people, and I was interacting, but it was just weird.
I just saw the pictures of that. That was a little bizarre.
Yeah,
oh,
I felt
it
like
was an interview. You were there the whole time.
Turtles. Yeah, I was. They Skyped me in at the start of it. I did the first reading, and then I stayed so I could listen to Eric Beatner and Josh Stallings read, and Steve S.W. Loudon, and then three musicians played. I'm forgetting their names right now, but they were really really good. And they did, you know, acoustic covers of replacement songs. And it was just a surreal experience to think that I was watching, effectively, I was watching a kind of a Replacements tribute gig for a project that I'd been involved in. It was very, very strange.
Yeah, it looked awesome. And it makes me, you know, I forget how many great authors are involved in this. Josh Stallings, Mr. Beatner. And it just, you know, the list goes on. When you look at the table of contents, it really,
totally.
Tell me a little bit about Josh Flanagan. What's his story?
Josh is, I'd say I've known him for a long time, but known isn't quite the right thing. I've known him for a few years. He co-hosts a podcast, a comic book podcast called iFanboy, which is, it's showing my geek side here. That's the first podcast I ever listened to, and I listened to it in, I think, episode 2 or something, which was back in 2005, when I was kind of living on my own after a marriage breakup. So, you know, as you do, you find a comic book podcast. Because, you know,
it
beats drugs.
Go ahead.
I've been listening to him. Yeah, well, I'd already made those mistakes once. I wanted to make whole new ones. So I was listening to his show for years and years and years, and then he's got a book of his own that he wrote, put it on Kindle, called Astro Van, I think. I might be getting that wrong. So I'd always kind of known that he was a good writer, but that he wasn't known for it. You know, he wasn't really putting written work out into the world. So the way the project worked was there were some people, you know, I put out a call for people to contribute. But there were some people who I knew I wanted to approach to see what their take on it would be. And he was one of them. I wanted to see what story he would give me. And when he was sending me rough drafts, again, he was someone who, and it's a completely different story to Angels, but in the same way, it showed that it was just someone who understood that it didn't have to be what you think of when you think of crime fiction. It's kind of a small slice of someone's kind of, you know, a single mother's kind of working class life. And that's really all the story is. And I don't mean all stories in a bad way. What I mean is he kind of got that that's what it could be. It didn't have to be someone walks in with a gun or anything like that. So that was, again, that was a story when I thought that, yeah, this is going to work, and here's someone else who gets it.
Yeah, you know, it's almost as if we could have put on the back cover, you know, 25 crime writers take a break from crime fiction to contribute, because it really is. It's a pause, and it's a different voice for, well, maybe not Johnny Shaw, but it's a different voice for a lot of the crew, and it was a refreshing read, and I like you know, just from having edited the Flash Fiction Offensive, and Angel, you probably know this too. When something comes in that's different, it pushes the envelope. It's not the cookie cutter thing you expect. It just, it's so refreshing, and it's such a nice break.
Oh, Jesus Christ, yes. Yeah. I mean, we just got
My name's Tom, but I go by.
You know, I'll put the call out. We want more submissions at Shotgun right now. But we just got one recently that I think we're putting up soon. That was like a friggin' end of the world narrative in 700 words, and it was like, holy crap, this is great. You know?
Yeah.
Fine, but it finally did something a little different, and you know, you get excited when that happens.
Yeah, I agree. And which is how the book felt to me.
Speaking of different, should we let Angel give a plug for his other thing that he's got?
Oh, Jesus.
I'm referring to VD or something, but
yeah,
the world is listening, Angel.
Yeah, December 5th, my next novella, it's called No Happy Endings. Best way to potentially pitch this is a sperm bank robbery without a real robbery, but ex-safecracker, taking a little from thief, doing one last job, and it all kind of goes to shit in all the worst possible ways. And biggest monkey wrench of all is it's happening during Superstorm Sandy, so it's for lack of a better term, messy.
Could you please repeat the release date?
December 5th, this year, 2018,
right around the corner.
Down and Out Books. Yeah, a couple weeks.
Excellent. Down and Out Books, the new king of the small presses.
I know, they've been rocking it, man. I think I'm officially like 100% with them. I'm not sure how things are working out, but I've got a short story collection coming out with them next year too.
I've got a novel coming out with them next year, so we'll be elbowing each other in the promo line.
Hell yeah. Let's do it.
Well, this has been fabulous, gentlemen. I'm going to, you know, we were only supposed to run half an hour here, but we ran a little bit over, but since it's our show, we make the rules. But I do want to thank you both. Angel for calling in, and Jay especially for not only being a great guest, but helping this book come to be and come to pass. And it's a great book. And if you haven't already bought it, go out and you can get it on Amazon, or you can just hunt it down from one of the contributors, perhaps. But it's Waiting to Be Forgotten, and it's out from Gutter Books, which I have absolutely nothing to do with. And both of you, enjoy your evening, and we will we'll do it again in about a month when I don't know who our guest is, but we'll let you know soon on Skid Row Chatter. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
Tom.